Good morning, welcome. Thank you very much for staying after this incredibly interesting press conference of USG Fletcher. So let's start now with the usual press briefing of the Information Service here in Geneva. Today is Tuesday, 3rd of December, and I would like to start by introducing you Magdalena Sepulveda Carmona, the new director of UNRIS. You may remember that we have distributed to you the announcement by the Secretary General of her nomination, and now she's here in flesh and bones to tell us about her new appointments and the priorities for her mandate. Magdalena.
Thank you very much. Good morning. It's a pleasure for me to be here. I've been a month in this new role as the director of UNRIS, and I'm delighted to meet you. As the first Latin American woman to lead the organization, I bring a deep commitment to social justice, human rights, and social inclusion, which are the main values of UNRIS mission. Through my career, and before this, for example, being the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Extreme Poverty and Human Rights, I've been seeing firsthand the importance of policy-backed research and how this research can make a change and transform societies. So why UNRIS and why is UNRIS important? And I guess that is the reason that I'm here. UNRIS is uniquely positioned as the only autonomous research institute of the UN to do research on social development. And we are coming to a very important event in 2025 in which UNRIS can play an important role. We have the World Summit on Social Development, the second summit in Qatar. We have the Financial for Development Summit. For 60 years, UNRIS has been providing cutting-edge research to tackle the root causes of inequality and injustice, and we will be bringing these topics to the discussion in the next year. Our main value is our network of researchers. Annually, we work with more than 400 researchers from the Global South, for whom 50% are women. And today, I want to say that one important task of UNRIS is to engage with media. We can help to translate complex research into real-world story to highlight the impact behind the data and bring critical issues to light. So we would like to work closely with all of you. We are actually, for those who are located in Geneva, we are in the S1 building, one floor below you, and we wish to start a closer collaboration with all of you as we move forward to this important event. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madalena. And of course, you know Karima Sharif, my right, who's in charge of communication. So if you listen to Magdalena's appeal for a stronger communication and relation with the journalist, Karima is here to help on this. Any question to UNRIS then to Magdalena in the room? I see no hands or on the platform either. So thank you very much for coming and introducing yourself. Welcome, bienvenida, and we'll see you soon, hopefully. The first big events will wait for you to brief the journalist here. Okay, so let's go now to Syria, and I'd like to ask Jeremy to come to the podium. We have Jeremy Lawrence for OHCHR to tell us about the latest development in Syria and its impact on human rights, and Margaret has brought us Christina Betke, hope I pronounce it well, who's the acting WHO representative in Syria, and she is joining us from Damascus. I can see you are there, Christina. That's perfect. That's great. So I'll start with Jeremy, and then we will go to you, and then we will take questions from the journalist. Jeremy.
Thanks. thanks, Alessandra, and good morning, everyone. UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Volker Türk is extremely concerned about the escalation in hostilities in northwest Syria since the 27th of November, which further compounds the suffering endured by millions of civilians. This is tragic, as many have lived in misery since the outbreak of conflict nearly 14 years ago. Our office has documented a number of extremely concerning incidents resulting in multiple civilian casualties, including a high number of women and children, stemming from attacks by both Harat Tahrir al-Shams, or HTS, and by pro-government forces. The hostilities are resulting in destruction and damage to civilian objects, including health facilities, buildings hosting institutions dedicated to education, and food markets. We are in the process of verifying deadly attacks impacting civilians. For example, on the 29th of November, four civilian men were killed, reportedly as a result of multiple ground-based strikes by HTS, hitting an area hosting the Aleppo University student dormitories in the Hamdaniya neighbourhood in the western part of the city of Aleppo. According to information gathered by our office, all victims were students of the university, and following that, many other students fled the university complex. On the 1st of December, 22 civilians were killed, including three women and seven children, and at least 40 others were injured, reportedly as a result of multiple airstrikes by pro-government forces in Idlib. According to information received, multiple airstrikes hit a local market and five residential areas in the city. Most of the victims were in the streets near their homes and in the market at the time of the airstrikes. The air attacks also caused significant damage to civilian houses, shops, and the local market, the Al Hayat Mosque and the Al Fatir Elementary School. We remind all parties of their obligations and responsibilities under international human rights law and humanitarian law. Civilians and civilian infrastructure must be protected. Even before 500,000 people fled across the border from the fighting in Lebanon in September, an estimated 16.7 million Syrians were in need of humanitarian assistance. It is tragic that so many have had to put up with such hardship for so long. Tens of thousands more people have been displaced since the 27th of November, and their situation is now critical as winter draws in. Life-saving assistance is largely unable to reach the conflict zone. Hospitals and public health facilities in Aleppo are running at maximum capacity and have limited staffing and supplies. We urge all parties to de-escalate, protect civilians, and allow vital aid to flow to those in need. Furthermore, we call on third parties with influence to do everything in their power to ensure compliance with international humanitarian law, promote dialogue, and to prevent this ongoing violence from exacerbating the suffering of the civilian people and from further inflaming regional tensions.
Thank you very much, Jeremy. And before giving the floor to WHO, I just would like to remind you that yesterday we have distributed it to you. The Secretary General said he was indeed alarmed by the recent escalation of violence across northwest Syria. He called for immediate cessation of hostilities, reminded all the parties of their obligations under international law, including humanitarian law, and called for an immediate return to the UN-facilitated political process in line with the Security Council Resolution 2254. As you know, Syria is already one of the world's largest humanitarian crises, as we have already heard, with 16.7 million people in need of assistance and over 7 million people internally displaced. More than half of million people have also fled to Syria from Lebanon in recent weeks, and winter conditions will only make the needs in the coming weeks more acute. Syrians have endured the conflict for nearly 14 years. They deserve a political horizon that will deliver a peaceful future, not more bloodshed. The Secretary General emphasized the urgent need for all parties to seriously engage with Geir Pedersen, his special envoy for Syria, to chart a comprehensive path out of conflict in line with this resolution of the Security Council. And on the health conditions in the area, let's listen now from Christine. And Margaret is here on the podium with me if you want to ask more questions. So Christina, you have the floor. Thank you.
Thank you so much, and good morning, good afternoon to folks from Damascus. Indeed, it's helpful to have Jeremy address all of you first because we share many perspectives around the recent and rapid escalation of violence across northwest Syria. It's cost not only lives, but has also placed an already fragile health system under immense, immense strain. Aleppo, Idlib, and Hama are at the forefront of this unfolding crisis, and we have already heard that people are bearing the weight of so many compounded emergencies over these many years. Aleppo City itself is home to 2 million people, including over 100,000 persons who were recently displaced from Lebanon to Syria and sought refuge there. 1 week ago, 109 health facilities were functioning to provide life-saving services as a result of so many years of investments by WHO and other partners to revitalize that health system. Today, fewer than 8 hospitals continue to operate at minimal capacity and are overwhelmed, as we've already heard. At the same time, yesterday's airstrikes in Idlib caused significant damage to healthcare facilities, and that includes the university hospital there, the maternity hospital, and the local health administration. In that area before the attack, we had 65 hospitals and 184 primary healthcare facilities functioning. And while we're still counting the casualties, the injuries, of which there are so many, numbering in the thousands, we see brave first responders, including the Syrian Arab Red Crescent, SARC, continue to swiftly evacuate the patients through coordinated referral systems. Those referral hospitals are overwhelmed with those trauma cases, and thousands of injuries have already been admitted in the last 4 days alone. Doctors and nurses, while they're in some cases limited, are working around the clock to save lives, even at great personal risk to themselves and their families, choosing to stay instead of to flee. Insecurity and restrictions on movement have forced around 65 non-governmental organizations that were previously operational in Aleppo and Idlib to suspend their activities. And in many cases, this is leaving health facilities overwhelmed or out of service. That includes one of Idlib's largest hospitals, Bab al-Hawa, and Al-Razi Hospital in Aleppo, both of which are reduced to serving emergency cases only and leaving countless patients in limbo. The referral system itself is a lifeline for so many, and it's now at risk. In Aleppo City, a fleet of nearly 40 ambulances desperately need repairs and fuel to continue operating. In other parts of the Northwest, currently only 86 of an original 125 ambulances remain functional. By the end of the year, that number will drop to just 19 ambulances that will be available to serve 5 million people unless urgent funding is secured, which will leave, of course, the most vulnerable and urgent cases without access to care. At the same time, as we've already heard, thousands of people have fled the growing insecurity and violence to different areas across Syria in search of safety. And so many of those have actually already experienced repeated displacements, including those who recently fled the escalating violence in Lebanon. And they are now being uprooted once again. These repeated displacements compound the suffering of already vulnerable communities and leave families without stability or access to essential services, including healthcare. In the midst of this crisis, public health concerns are escalating. If you recall, Aleppo and Idlib were at the center of the 2022-2023 outbreak of cholera in Syria, and of course were among the hardest hit areas in the 2023 earthquake, which damaged already fragile health facilities as well as water and sewer networks. We are very conscious of the risks of waterborne diseases, and restrictions on movements as well as closures of health facilities reduce our capacity for outbreak protection and disease response. We also know that overcrowded shelter settings will also leave populations vulnerable and at risk for illnesses like respiratory disease, lice, and scabies. Since the 27th of November, WHO has received through its surveillance system for attacks on healthcare reports of at least 6 attacks on healthcare in Syria. We echo the messages of the previous speaker advocating for the protection of healthcare workers and health facilities in Syria. Medical facilities are protected infrastructure under international humanitarian law, and failure to protect and respect healthcare devastates twice, first in the initial harm, and then again for the months and years it takes to rebuild the health system. Despite these immense challenges, WHO and its partners are working tirelessly to try to ensure that aid reaches those in need. On 1st of December, WHO supported an evacuation of 41 patients from Ibn Khaldun Hospital to other parts and other communities outside of Aleppo. These are vulnerable mental health patients who desperately needed to ensure continuity of care. And yesterday, on 2nd of December, following the devastating airstrikes in Idlib, health partners acted quickly to relocate all those patients that were needed continuity of hospital care, assess the damages, and restore those services. In the midst of some of the most violent escalation we've seen in the last 4 years in Syria, we are seeing countless examples of UN and its partners committing to stay and deliver humanitarian assistance to affected areas. But let me be clear, this will only be possible because of two critical elements, access and funding. Continued unhindered access on all sides is crucial to save lives and serve populations in need. Our hearts and minds are with Aleppo City in particular, where the UN and NGO community is awaiting reassurance of safe passage to relocate its non-essential staff and their families, while our critical staff remain behind to continue to serve. Health partners urgently need an injection as well of emergency resources to rapidly scale up the response. And so to our donors today, we are appealing for your urgent and generous response to enable health partners to provide emergency trauma care, ensure disease prevention, restore health essential health services that have been interrupted, and deliver those life-saving medicines and supplies. Medical teams are on the ground and life-saving supplies are being distributed, but this work is under threat as our already existing funding gaps grow wider. To the media partners here, we urge you to continue to amplify the voices of the Syrian people. Your coverage is not just reporting, but it is a lifeline. By highlighting stories like the imminent collapse of an ambulance referral system, you ensure that we cannot turn away. To the international community, we echo the remarks of our previous speaker as well. We must ensure that health workers, health facilities are secured, and health services are protected for those who need them most. The people of Syria continue to pay an unthinkable price in this conflict. They need our solidarity, our action, and our commitment. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Christina. I understand your note and, in fact, Jeremy's note have been distributed. And before opening the floor to questions, just a reminder that this afternoon, New York time, the Security Council will meet on the situation in Syria. And Jennifer, you will probably send out some more information after the meeting of the Security Council. And also, you have received in your mailboxes a press release by the Independent International Commission of Inquiry on the Syrian Arab Republic. I think we have told you everything we had on this question, and I'll open the floor now. Agnes, so I introduce you for Christina. Agnes Pedrero, AFP.
Yes, thank you for taking my question. It's a question concerning what you mentioned about the fact that in Aleppo City, the UN and NGO communities. No? C'est bon maintenant? Okay, so I will repeat it, sorry. So a question about what you said about Aleppo City, where the UN and NGO communities are waiting for a safe passage to relocate the non-essential staff and families. Could you let us know more about how many people are you talking about globally? Where do you want to send those peoples, and which exactly in, assurance are you waiting for from which parties? And you are also asking for more funds, emergency funds. How much are you waiting for? Thank you, or asking for?
Christina.
Thank you so much. So prior to the outbreak of this recent escalation, the UN in Aleppo had around 300 national staff and 25 international staff based in Aleppo. All of the UN agencies have defined their critical staff that they would like to keep in Aleppo and are also planning to evacuate both the family members of those staff who stay behind, as well as other non-critical staff, both international and national. I am not personally in charge of the evacuation process that is handled by OCHA and UNDSS. As I understand it, they are looking to deconflict with all parties. There are, as you know, clashes ongoing in many parts of the country right now, including the road that we would use to evacuate, which is called Khan Asad Road. And because of continued ongoing hostilities, it hasn't been a safe moment for us to be to relocate those staff. And I want to emphasize that this at this time is not an evacuation, but a relocation of those non-essential staff. They would be moved to Damascus at this time. And then of course the UN will reassess after we're able to move folks and see what the current situation and the future situation would be from security wise. In your second question, prior to the outbreak of these hostilities, the WHO itself was had about an 89% funding gap, and the overall health sector humanitarian response plan was only around 21% funded. So we would certainly continue to do some of the same activities that are planned under the humanitarian response plan. And of course, those will be additionally, additional needs will result because of this escalation and the displacement that we're seeing.
Thank you very much. And yes, you have a follow-up?
Yes, thank you. Given Jens is still in the room, maybe you can brief us about this relocation issues.
Back. Is he back? I can't see you, Jens. Sorry. Sure. Please come to the podium. He was hiding under Mikael, behind Mikael. Where is he? Oh, he's right there. Yes, right there. Oh, you're here. Okay. Go ahead. About the relocation. Okay, so let's go to a second question where Jens organizes his notes. Any other question in the room? I've got quite a few on the platform, but just... Nina.
Sorry, I had another question, which was for Jeremy. I was just wondering, you mentioned the civilians who've been killed, and I was wondering if you're seeing signs of targeting of war crimes, if you could talk to that. And for Christina, if you could say about the attacks that you've seen on healthcare, if it looks like they are targeted. Thank you.
We can't go into the specifics on the war crimes angle, but what we can say is that we're aware of a large number of civilians and civilian infrastructure, which, as you know, is protected under IHL, have been damaged and civilians have been killed. We're in the process, it's early days, of verifying the information that we're getting. I gave you some examples this morning. There are many more examples, sadly, many more. We hopefully will be able to share some more details on this with you imminently.
I haven't forgotten you, Agnes. Give one more moment to Jens. Any other question in the room? Yep. Pardon me?
Sorry, I asked WHO also about attacks
sorry,
on...
Oh, sorry, that's right, that's right. I was talking to you, sorry. Christina?
Yes, thank you. Just to clarify, WHO's surveillance for attacks on healthcare focuses on the impact of those attacks, and it doesn't have a mandate to look at perpetration, assign blame, or motive to those. So I apologize, I cannot speak to your question.
Yeah, very clear. Thank you very much, Christina. I'll give the floor to Jens now to answer Agnes' question.
Could you repeat the question, please?
Yes. Yes, if you could give us more explanations and numbers about how many people the UN and the NGO communities is trying to relocate from Aleppo City.
Right, thank you. There is a number of UN staff in Aleppo City and also in Hama. They are there for the time being. And as you know, we also have other staff that support the cross-border operation, and the cross-border, the three entry points remain open. So there's response there. So I cannot go into details for security reasons exactly how many staff are where, but they're there, and we are concerned for their well-being, of course.
Agnes?
Yes, the question was also about the non-essential staff. That Christina was saying that UN is trying to relocate outside Aleppo City.
Yeah, in a situation like this, I don't go into what is clearly safety and security procedures of the United Nations. So,
Jamie? Oh, no, it was. I saw your hand there. Jamie? Isabel?
Yes, yes, please. If you, I understood that your yes is right. I understood that aid is unable to reach the parts of Syria, Aleppo, Hama, and the other. Is unable to reach people there. So, what are the coordinations that OSHA or UN in general is doing? With whom to be able to get to the people in need, or to do whatever is possible to support people in this situation. If you can explain who are the interlocutors. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. And it's a valid and fair question. It's also valid and fair to say that it's a very fluid and constantly changing situation. We have for a very, very long time, because this has been going on for 13, 14 years, a very solid coordination mechanism inside Syria, as you know, and also run out of Gaziantep in Turkey for the cross-border operation, particularly looking at Idlib and the northwestern part where all this is happening. So they're both looking at this, and there are coordination mechanisms in place which are run by OCHA and have been run by OCHA for as long as I can remember. Of course, we remain in contact with the NGOs that we work with. We know, like, we have been forced to put our operations on hold because of the insecurity. A number of them have done the same. It is, when I say insecurity and lack of access, it's basically two things. It's, of course, the active acts of fighting, of hostilities, but it's also roads that are closed, right? So that is the situation. It is unfortunate. However, it's not the entire area that is just locked down. There are still places where we can respond. For example, in the reception centers in Idlib, to where we have seen a number of people moving to. There is a response going on there. We have two situation reports out last night, and I will share them with you after the briefing, where you can see some of the details of what is possible where security conditions allow.
Okay, should I go to the platform? I don't see other hands here, so sorry. Gabriela. Gabriela Sotomayor, Proceso.
Thank you very much, Alessandra. Good morning. My question is for Jeremy on Syria, and then after Syria, I have another question for Jeremy, so please don't go.
Jamie has another briefing. Jamie has another briefing issue, so let's stick it to Syria, and then when he gives his second point, Jeremy, we will ask questions. Go ahead.
Yeah. So my question is, if you observe, Jeremy, the same pattern of attacks of military against civilians, do you see the same pattern that we saw at the manifestations, for example, that military just shoot and targeted civilians in a very aggressive way? Do you see that?
Listen, I don't know if we can go into such detail on that. What we can say is we gave you those two examples of specific cases. So it was a school that was affected, it was a mosque, it was markets affected. Classic civilian infrastructure, which is protected under international humanitarian law. It's quite clear. And when civilians are killed, that is of real concern, and they are also protected, clearly, under international humanitarian law. I don't think we can jump to anything at this stage and say patterns with respect to other conflicts or situations, but we can present the facts to you, and the facts are as I've said earlier.
Thank you very much, Moussa. Moussa Assi Al-Mayedin.
Merci beaucoup. I have two questions. The first one for Jeremy, about the residents in Aleppo. Can you tell me if you have some details about the situation, a new situation after the control of Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, formerly Jabhat al-Nusra, and if there is any displaced from this city? And the second question for WHO. We saw difficult scenes in Aleppo hospitals, killed and injured in the corridors. Do you have a clear picture or clear image of the situation of hospitals in Aleppo? Thank you.
Sure, I can go first on that. As this is an evolving situation, I haven't got any more details to share with you on the situation as it stands in Aleppo. As I say, we're following the situation closely, and we will be providing an update.
Christina?
Yes, thank you. So also echoing those remarks, it is a very fluid situation. The early days, the hospitals were completely overwhelmed and most were closed and shut. We know at least 8 hospitals are functioning with some minimum capacity. And I do want to acknowledge that actually, in terms of reaching Aleppo, there has been the possibility for some medical teams working from the cross-border side to reach and support at least one hospital in Aleppo city from what we have understood. But we continue to monitor the situation, and things are very, very fluid on the ground in terms of the security situation as well as healthcare workers' presence in the city. So we will continue to update when we have information. Thank you.
Moussa, you have a follow-up?
Yes, I don't remember if you say something about the number of killed and injured in from the beginning of this campaign of war. Thanks.
Yeah, so I'll jump in there. At this stage, we don't have that number, but what I can say is that we are verifying numbers. I can tell you that I've seen some of the data which is coming out, and it suggests that there are certainly dozens upon dozens have been killed. We will have more clarity on that hopefully within the next 24 hours.
And I'm sure you'll keep the journalist informed. Yuri Aprilev, RIA Novosti.
Yes, thank you. I have one question for Jeremy about Syria and after about Georgia, but I will wait for the briefing on Georgia. So about Syria, I'm quite surprised because when I'm reading your statement and also when I was reading the statement of the Commission of Inquiry on Syria that was published this morning, it is about the words, my question. Your office is not calling Hayat Tahrir al-Sham a terrorist group. Hayat Tahrir al-Sham are Al-Qaeda in Syria. This is not something new. They changed the name in 2016 because they needed some money and weapons from other countries that were not agreeing to give weapons to Al-Qaeda. So they just changed the name. So I'm quite surprising when I'm reading your statements that there is nothing about that. We're talking about the territory of a sovereign country attacking by a terrorist armed group. So is your office considering the HTS as an opposition group, like any other, or as a terrorist group? And is your office considering that here, when we are talking about this situation, it is about a state attacked by an armed terrorist group, or it is just something that is intern to Syria, has nothing to do with terrorism? Thank you.
Yes, I really don't want to get drawn into the politics of who's fighting who and for what reason. What we are drawing your attention to is applicability of international humanitarian law and the protection of civilians and civilian infrastructure. It's really that simple. That's what our office is calling out here. Protection of civilians, civilian infrastructure.
Thank you very much, Jamie.
Thank you. I had a question for Christina, if I might.
Sorry, Jamie Keaton, AP.
Associated Press. Thank you very much. I just wanted to get a clarification on the figures that you came out with at the beginning. You mentioned that a 1 week ago, 109 health facilities were functioning, and today fewer than 8 hospitals continue to operate at minimal capacity and overwhelmed. Presumably, those hospitals are just part of the 109. Could you tell us how many health facilities in general are operating right now?
Thank you so much for the question. I'm sorry to keep echoing the same remarks, but it's very fluid on the ground. And of course, access in our ability to monitor in real time is somewhat restricted by the security situation. As of yesterday, we knew at least 8 hospitals had minimal functionality. We also saw some promising changes where some hospitals were able to even start accepting internal medicine cases, not just trauma and emergency cases. Additionally, we have also heard reports of at least 3 primary healthcare centers of the Directorate of Health, as well as at least 1 primary healthcare center operated by an NGO, being able to restart some minimal services. But I think it's really important for us to understand this is really hour by hour, and the security situation, the access situation is very dynamic. And really, again, echoing back to the main points that have been said and the protection of healthcare and healthcare workers and health facilities and ensuring access are really what we need to emphasize in this situation so that we can ensure that these health services are restored through whichever access point and means we can use to ensure those services are there for the population. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any other question? Yeah, Agnes, go ahead.
Yes, just a quick follow-up to what Jamie asked. So you say that 8 hospitals are working with minimal minimal capacity, but 8 out of how many for Aleppo City? Thank you.
Thank you. So before the 27th of November, we had, I'm just looking for the number so I don't misquote you, and it's in your script remarks as well if it's helpful. So we had 42 hospitals and 67 primary healthcare centers that were either fully or partially functional ahead of the 27th of November. That includes both public, academic, private, and faith-based institutions.
Sorry, sure.
Thank you for that. Jamie again from AP. So the number you just said is 42, and then 8 are minimally functioning. I'm doing the math here. That's 34 that are now affected. I mean, can you give us an impact on those 34? And is that all resulting from what's happened since November 27th?
Yes, I think your numbers are right. And that's what we know today. And again, it's possible because we're not able to travel to all parts of Aleppo City right now. And we're trying to remain in touch with all health facilities as much as we can, literally with doctors, nurses on the ground. But indeed, this is the overall impact as we understand it. And I think day by day, we are hearing from different institutions that are starting to just restart services ever so slightly, getting their healthcare workers back, finding a way to operate and provide minimal services. There certainly has been an almost unanimous desire by health partners that we speak to want to support and restart services. And I also want to acknowledge that the support from the other side has also been quite earnest and committed to try to work from whatever means we can to restart health services, irrespective of who is the actor, who is the operator, but making sure that those services are there. So I do believe you will start to see bit by bit a change and a restarting of services, but that will be very dependent upon the security situation and the access situation.
John Zarokostas, France 24, in the Lancet.
Yes, good morning. Can you hear me there?
Ken, go ahead.
Yes. My question is to the representative from WHO. If you can bring us up to speed, the number of medical professionals that have left Syria since the conflict started back in 2011, do we know the numbers that have left? I know the numbers were very big, for instance, in Iraq during the conflict, and there have been quite a lot in Syria. Do you have to give us an idea what is the total that have left? Thank you.
Thank you for your question. In terms of exact figures, I don't have because we don't have a full health worker census. There was a lot of movement throughout the conflict, but estimates range between 50 and 70%. A number of different figures have been published on that over the years. And most of the time we see between 50 and 70% figures quoted.
Thank you very much. I think this concludes the question on this important subject. Christina, thank you so much for being here. Margaret, thank you. I don't know if there will be more questions for you, but I let you go. Yeah, sure. And Jens too. But I keep Jeremy for the second part of his briefing, and this time it's on Georgia. And I haven't forgotten that, Gabriele, you have a question for Jeremy later on. And Yuri will have a question on Georgia. So I'll let you brief on Georgia first, and then we'll take Gabriela's question.
Sure. Thank you, Alessandra. As you know, we issued yesterday evening a statement on the events taking place in Georgia. Last night, the protests continued in the capital, Tbilisi, and police forces used tear gas and water cannons to disperse demonstrators in front of the parliament building. We reiterate the call by the UN Human Rights Chief Volker Türk on Georgian authorities to respect and protect the rights to freedom of expression and peaceful assembly. The use of unnecessary or disproportionate force against demonstrators and media workers is extremely worrying. Any use of force by security personnel must remain an exception and comply with the principles of legality, necessity, proportionality, precaution, and non-discrimination. All Georgians from across the political spectrum should be able to express their views about the future of their country freely and peacefully.
Indeed. Question in the room on Georgia? Then I'll ask Yuri to ask his question on this matter.
Yes, thanks. It's also about the yesterday's statements. Your office is considering that the authorities are using disproportionate force against the protesters. Yet the past days we have seen videos and footage of hooded protesters throwing Molotov cocktails, fireworks, stones and bottles against the policemen. So I'm asking, is your office considering that these protestations are peaceful? And what should be the reaction of the authorities and of the police, according to your office, to attempt the inflame of policemen and the take possession of parliament? Because this is what is we are talking about. The protests are in front of the parliament and the protesters are trying to take it by force. The last time when we have seen violent protesters trying to forcibly take over parliament, it was in the capital in 2021. In the capital, four protesters were killed, 600 people were arrested, and your office never said that the policemen in Washington, D.C. were using disproportionate force. So I'm wondering what is the difference now and before. Thanks.
Yes, thanks for your question. Two things. One, the High Commissioner in his statement yesterday did refer to force by the police in the capital. Secondly, the High Commissioner did also refer to the protesters themselves and reminded them, called upon them to act peacefully in their demonstrations. We indicated yesterday in the press release that that reports had shown that on occasions rocks had been thrown, fireworks and bottles at the security forces, and damage had been caused to the Parliament building.
Thank you. Other question on Georgia? Don't see any hand up. So, Gabriella, you want to ask your question to Jeremy before we let him go?
Yes, thank you, Alessandra. Jeremy, my Mexican friend, journalist Yohali Resendiz, then I will write you the name. She had received death threats, and she received threats that they are going to rape her, to cut her in pieces, to kill her. I mean, she received serious threats. So my question is, what she needs to do? Because the authorities in Mexico are not giving her any security. So she's not in the mechanism of protection of journalists. So she has the help of Article 19, but I don't know if you can suggest her any more things to do, or what can she do?
thanks for your question. And what you're telling me sounds truly awful. I cannot really make a detailed comment because we don't know the extent, the information. We need more information. And listen, if you could share that with us, obviously we will follow it up. But let me just be clear that threatening journalists is abhorrent in any form. And journalists should be allowed to carry out their work in a manner which is the right way to do their job. And that is to provide information to the public. Listen, I what you've just explained to me sounds awful, and perhaps you can share some more information on that. Thank you.
Thank you very much to take this offline because it sounds very serious. So if there are no... Oh, yes, Jeremy. Jimmy, to Jeremy.
Question for Jeremy. Jeremy, what is the presence of OHCHR on the ground in Georgia at the moment? I mean, staffing levels, I know you have an office there, but are they monitoring firsthand the situation, or is most of the sourcing that you're, the stuff that you're mentioning based on secondary source?
Jamie, I'll need to get back to you on the precise numbers, but we are following the situation very, very closely, yes.
Okay, thank you very much, Jeremy, for these briefings. Let me go to my right, to Babar. Happy Tuesday. And thank you very much for being here to tell us about the pledging conference that you are going to have soon.
Thank you. Happy Tuesday. Good morning, dears. Just a short announcement. UNHCR's annual pledging conference is currently taking place here at the Palais. This is an annual event, and it can be followed via the UN TV, and it's expected to run till 1 p.m. today. We will issue a press release in the afternoon, including the pledges announced by our donors. Donors will pledge against UNHCR's 2025 global appeal, which is a detail of our operations, needs, and programs globally, which seeks 10.24 8 billion US dollars in funding for 2025 to support forcibly displaced and stateless people in 136 countries across the world. UNHCR's global appeal describes our expectations for 2025, the budget we will require to respond to their needs, and the actions that we plan to take. Thank you.
Thank you, Babar. Thank you very much for this announcement. Any question to UNHCR? Online, John Zarokostas.
Yes, good morning, Baba. Just a clarification. The 10.24 billion, will that be folded into the global humanitarian overview appeal that's being launched tomorrow in Geneva? In other words, your figure will be part of that global appeal along with other agencies, just to avoid confusion in editorial rooms. Thank you.
I think my simple understanding is that, John, but I can cross-check. Thank you.
Yeah, the global appeal that you've heard from Mr. Fletcher this morning, I think that's what he refers to. Yeah. All right. No other question from UNHCR. Thank you very much, Babar. And our last speaker is Anna Copeland from the International Federation of the Red Cross and Red Crescent. Anna, you are online. Just to announce did I hear something? No? Is she online? To tell us about the upcoming International Volunteers Day.
Thank you, Alessandra. Good to be here. In the lead up to International Volunteers Day on Thursday, 24 national Red Cross and Red Crescent societies around the world, including, among others, Venezuela, Italy, Greece, Netherlands, Nigeria, Singapore, and Pakistan are and have been gathering in their cities to pay tribute to colleagues that we have very sadly lost this year. 31 volunteers and staff from the IFRC network have been killed in 2024 while performing their humanitarian duties, and many other humanitarian workers from other organizations too, of course. Those 31 people were not just our colleagues, but also beloved family members, friends, and pillars of their communities who risked their lives to help others. 2024 has become the deadliest year on record for local humanitarian staff and volunteers, and this trend must stop. Humanitarians, including our staff and volunteers, must be protected. We'd like to invite journalists to attend a Protect Humanity event outside IFRC headquarters in Geneva tomorrow, that's the 4th of December, beginning at 4 p.m. Geneva time. At the event, we will honour the memory of those colleagues killed in the line of duty and raise awareness of the urgent need to protect humanitarians everywhere. Tomorrow, there will be approximately 250 IFRC staff members and volunteers present. Our undersecretary will make some remarks, as will a volunteer from the Geneva Red Cross, and the names of the colleagues we have lost this year will also be read out with candles, the Red Cross, Red Crescent emblems, and pictures of those colleagues as a backdrop. We think it will and hope it will be a powerful and moving visual. And AV materials are available from the different national societies taking part globally on request. So we hope to see you there. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Hannah. Any question to IFRC in the room or online? I don't see any. So thank you very much for that. A few announcements from me. First of all, just to remind you that you are the lucky persons who are going to listen from the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Volker Türk, that is giving you a press conference on Monday, 9th of December at 10:30 from this room. And this is the, I think it's, I could say, usual end-of-year press conference by the High Commissioner. So again, 9th of December, 10:30 here. We have sent you the invitation online. Also on human rights, the two committees which are on at the moment, the Committee on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination, which is examining this morning the review of the report of Armenia, and we'll go on with the one of Greece and the one of Kenya, while the Committee on the Protection of the Rights of All Migrants, Workers, and Members of Their Family is concluding this morning the report of Benin, and this afternoon we'll start with Egypt, followed by Peru and Seychelles. an important day today, the International Day of Persons with Disabilities. The Secretary General said in his statement, in his message that we have distributed to you, that this year's International Day of Persons with Disability reminds us that we need to the leadership of persons with disabilities more than ever. Persons with disability are already disproportionately bear the brunt of the crisis scarring our world because of persistent discrimination, stigma, and barriers to basic rights and services. He goes on saying, through the recently adopted Pact for the Future, the countries of the world committed to correcting this injustice for persons with disabilities of all ages for present and future generations. Next year's World Summit for Social Development that we've heard about this morning will be a key moment to carry these and other commitments forward. And the Secretary General, to conclude on this important day and every day, let's work with persons with disabilities to achieve an inclusive and sustainable future for all people. There is a commemoration for this important day at the UN in New York, and we do have our own events here at the Palais. It's an event on neurodiversity, and it will see, this is organized by UNOG together with the Hôpitaux Universitaires de Genève. It's a panel discussion which title is Neurodiversity at Work, Sustainable Employability and Disability Inclusion in the Workplace. And it aims at improving understanding of neurodiversity in the workplace and promote inclusive practices that enhance sustainable employability for all. Quite a few speakers. It will take place in room 23 at 12 o'clock, so very soon, until 2 p.m. And yeah, I think that is all I have for you. Two more international days, tomorrow and the day after, International Day of Banks and International Volunteer Day for Economic and Social Development and World Soil Day. We've sent you the statements of the Secretary General. Is there any question for me in the room or online? No. So thank you very much for following this briefing and the press conference of USG Fletcher, and I'll see you on Friday. Thank you.